Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink. A little later, we've got Mike Johnston and John Walsh from the Michigan Manufacturers Association to talk to us about unemployment, the Unemployment Trust Fund, and other issues that are going on with manufacturing right now. But first, we're joined by our old friends Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight and Bob LeBrant, formerly with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. He's since retired and he's got his own business that he's doing or his own interest that he's pursuing. But the reason we've got you on, Ed, is I understand you and Bob have kind of come up with an idea that may be an answer to the term limits issue. Why don't you tell our listeners how this came about?
How this came about? Well, Bob and I, for almost 30 years now, have been working together and talked about what do we do with term limits. There's always been an interest in changing the term limits, not to say eliminating, but changing them. But nobody wants to pay to put it on the ballot. And so he says, how do you do that? Well, the only way to put that on the ballot then is a three-quarters vote in both chambers of the legislature, state senate and state house.
Okay, so what we're talking about here is allowing legislators to run again for office, but the voters have to write their names in.
Yes, correct. In their partisan primary.
All right. So, Bob, tell me your thoughts on this.
This year marks 29 years that term limits has been part of the Michigan Constitution. And I've seen efforts, frankly, crash and burn to try to make any modifications to our term limits in Michigan. And as far as the state legislature is concerned, Michigan alone has the most draconian term limits in the nation. We used to share that with California and Arkansas, but those two states amended their constitution to allow for a little bit more flexibility on the part of state legislators. Here in Michigan, you know, there have been efforts. As recently as I think 2 weeks ago, Judge Janet Neff out in the Western District of Michigan dismissed a lawsuit that was brought by, I think, a coalition of 10 Republican and Democratic former legislators to have our term limits declared unconstitutional under the 1st and 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Once that happened, and when Ed gave me a call, I all of a sudden thought, you know, waiting around for the courts to throw out term limits or waiting around for some group to come forward and say, we're going to lead a petition drive is not the answer. The answer is the legislature itself has the constitutional power to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, frankly, at any time. If we did a petition drive, the earliest we could put that question on the ballot via a petition drive would be November of 2022. Well, that means that 46 term limited legislators are basically out of luck. They're going to be term limited and history will pass them by. But if, as Ed pointed out, if the legislature were to take up a House joint resolution sometime between now and the end of August and get a two-thirds vote in both the House and the Senate for that proposal, then they could put it on, for instance, the November 2nd, 2021 ballot as a special election. It would correspond with all these municipal elections that are going to be held around the state this coming November. So the more Ed and I thought about this, looking at the model that Ed brought to my attention, using the Rochester Hills City Charter, of all things, to see how they deal with mayoral term limits, seemed to me that could be adapted to the state house and the state senate. So in your final term in the state legislature, if you decided that you wanted to run with this constitutional amendment, if you wanted to run for an additional term in either the state house or the state senate, you would run as a write-in in that particular primary coming up in August of 2022. If you defeated anybody else who was on the primary ballot, or you were running unopposed and you filed a declaration of intent, if you got, let's say, 5% of the total vote cast in that district for a, let's say, the top of the ticket candidate, like candidate for governor, then you would qualify as that party's nominee for the November ballot in 2022. And if elected then, then you get to serve another term, whether it's a two-year term in the state house or a four-year term in the state senate.
And you could do that indefinitely then? So indefinitely you could do that.
I mean, frankly, that's up to the legislature.
Okay.
If they want to tweak the proposal that we've come up with and say, well, you can only do that once or you can only do that three times, you know, that's up to the legislature in the legislative process.
We do know from past experience, Bob and I doing polling, that if it becomes totally unlimited, like your 30th term, people are not going to support that, okay? The goal here, the fact is, like Bob said, we want the legislature to decide that, but we would suggest that the fact you have to put some limit eventually on it, because people will view this as just like we've got now, no term limits. We have to give them some break, whether that's a fifth term or a sixth term. I think there has to be some limits.
It kind of seems to me, guys, that this might be something that would work really well in pockets of the state, but they would be the minority, not the majority of the areas. Is that a fair assessment? If not, why?
Well, basically, I mean, this is a partisan primary. It doesn't impact general elections, okay? So the bottom line is either side, if they've got an incumbent, they could run again for a third term in their partisan primary. It does not impact general elections. It's all about the primary, because we figured you're not going to get anything passed as a partisan issue. This is not a partisan issue, okay? This comes down to, can you and your partisan state rep or state representative get written in on that primary ballot that applies statewide?
Bob, are you guys thinking the same thing for governor, lieutenant, or secretary of state, attorney general?
We haven't gotten that far yet.
I don't think that's the issue. I mean, you know, in the long history of Michigan, we've had two individuals who have served more than 8 years as governor, John Engler at 12, and Bill Milliken through some circumstances, 14 years. Obviously, in other constitutional offices like attorney general, you know, Frank Kelly was the eternal general. He served, 37 years as attorney general. And as far as, you know, secretary of state, Richard Austin, you know, served from 1970 to 1994, 24 years. I don't think that those are the same issues as the state legislature. I think the state legislature as an institution is severely injured by having this rotation, you know, every 6 years in the House and every 8 years in the Senate. And of course, the rotation is probably perhaps greater, you know, in the state House, because they come there generally as new people, and some will eventually move over to the Senate, but not many of them. And so I think that the real crisis here is the lack of institutional knowledge and experienced leadership. And that's due to state legislative term limits, not constitutional officer term limits.
And as a matter of fact, working as a staffer, or working as a lobbyist, working with associations and groups, the issues always come when trying to get good policy has been the House and the Senate. Because either they don't have the knowledge where lobbyists in the audience are telling them how to run their meetings, or you have people have no knowledge, or they're there for a short time just looking who they're going to get a job from when they leave office. So that's where our focus has been.
But the emphasis has been on trying to reform our term limits, is to, you know, kind of double the amount of time they can spend in the legislature. This proposal avoids that public discussion and says, hey, if they want to extend their service in the legislature, let's do it on a term-by-term basis, whether that's 4 years in the state Senate or 2 years in the state House. And I think people would see that as a rather modest proposal and give it, frankly, a strong likelihood of success.
Only I've done in Rochester Hills, asking people specific on the issue, majority say they're okay with the write-in policy, that their mayor now will be running maybe for a fifth or sixth term, because that they're there. I mean, do they like term limits? Yeah, they like the term limits. They're not against write-in to prove that you are still warranted to run more than a two-year or a 2-4-year terms.
So have you guys talked to any legislators about this? Got any feedback from anyone else on the idea?
We just tossed the idea around on Friday.
So we were looking for the two most intelligent individuals in the state of Michigan who would understand this issue. We came up with Kyle, Mylene, and John Ruhring, you know, to take the lead on this with getting the message about this to create a conversation. Yes, we're willing to talk to everybody,
Well, thanks for tossing around the idea. We'll see if legislators pick it up and want to do anything with it. There's a lot of other things that I wanted to tap on your expertise on. And first, Ed, with you, the news from last week about the census numbers not coming in until April, how big of a problem is that going to be? And what do you see the redistricting process shaping up to look like from a time standpoint?
The problem is going to be not because it's showing up in July, it's because the fact that people who have to do this have no background in redistricting. The pressure on them is to get something out so the voters know how they're going to be voting. The CSU is saying, we got to change our precinct, we got to change our boundaries. It's more on the commission side. Bob and I talked about this the other day. For those who have experience, if we got them in July, we still would have time to crank out the maps, okay? Because we understand what the data is and what we have to do. The problem is the commission with no experience, because they got to pass the rules. They're going to decide how they're going to draw the lines. They're going to have to go around this. The problem is they'll have a short part of time to meet the conditions of the Secretary of State by which they have to have their plans voted on and submit to the Secretary of State to put it on the ballot for August of next year.
I don't think it's going to be a big crisis here in Michigan as it would be if we were in a state like Virginia or New Jersey that will have state legislative elections, you know, in November. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they will probably be hard-pressed to get new district lines in place, you know, for the upcoming November off-year elections that they have in those two states. For Michigan, you know, we won't have candidate filing deadline until sometime next April. There'll be plenty of time for the Commission on the Independent Redistricting Commission to come up with boundaries for Congress, for state Senate and state House.
And I would assume that the legislature staffers will be ordered to start developing tentative plans to submit as examples to the commission. So if the commission is not ready for review of some plans, there'll be examples from the House and Senate Democrats, House and Senate Republicans to submit to the commission if it gets into a bind, gets ideas where they can go as a commission.
And nobody's going to be shocked that Michigan, when they eventually get these numbers out, is that for another decade on top of other decades, we'll lose one member of the House of Representatives. And so we'll have a delegation size of 13 and approximately 10 million people to draw those lines for those 13 districts.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Bob, because one of the things we were talking about earlier today was about majority-minority districts. And have you even given it any thought as to how you can craft two majority-minority districts in the state of Michigan by taking one district out and what those two districts could possibly look like?
Well, from my side, who have already drawn example plans, is that you still can retain two black seats based in Detroit. The conversation of having one black district in the city of Detroit to make it a super majority minority, I don't think will fly in the court process. You can still draw a district. The question is which other seat do you eliminate? The Sandy 11, the new McLean district, the Wahlberg, the Upton seat, the Meyer district, or something in the center of the state. This can be done and still maintain the black seats, because I would think the one thing the commission does want to get into is being forced to take their plans to the Supreme Court, either at the state or the federal level, because they'll lose control of the process.
So what do those two districts look like then, Ed?
Detroit roughly stays the same. They'll be split in the center with the points. And then if you're looking at Brenda Lawrence, you move up into Macomb County, and probably the current plan where she will change very little. Actually pick up some population further south and pushing more of Debbie Dingell into Washtenaw County. But basically, the city will not change. Basically, we'll shift more out of Oakland County, maybe into southern Macomb County, to make up additional black voters and make the two black districts.
From my judgment, is that with a constitutional amendment that was adopted back in 2018, you know, compliance with the Voting Rights Act is still number one before you get to other criteria. So I think there's going to be two majority-minority districts that get drawn. I don't know how that's going to look. Ed unlike Ed, I don't have a computer with all sorts of databases loaded onto it. But I would think that when the population between 2000 and 2010, the city of Detroit lost 25% of its entire population. Where did that population go? Well, it went across 8 miles. And, you know, it was in Southfield, it was in Farmington Hills, West Bloomfield, That's where the migration from Detroit has gone, and it's been into Oakland County. Now, it also has some effect in Macomb County as well. And I think Ed's probably right. You know, Brenda Lawrence, you know, may have more territory that goes into perhaps southern Macomb. At the same time, you got to deal with, you know, you got 10-11, you know, who represents a kind of a combination district of southern Macomb and Oakland County. Depending upon how other factors enter into it, I think McLean may be an endangered species after only one term.
Really? So you think McLean's seat is more at risk than Andy Levin's?
Let me explain why. First of all, if you're going to maintain McLean's seat, her district has to be pushed north and to west. Guess what she runs into? Genesee County. She runs into Dan Kildee's district. Okay. If you push her north to make up the population that Brenda Lawrence and Senator Lemon's going to need, she's going to become more Democratic as a district. And that's going to make that McLean seat very competitive. Or basically, if Dan Kildee runs again, if he'll maintain part of that district, it'll be very difficult for her to win that seat.
So what if her district goes south, though? Because you could make the argument that Andy Levin's seat is the most endangered.
And her district becomes more Democratic in that direction. And you lose the black seat. She's probably the most boxed in congressional district. No matter whether she goes north or south, she's going to become more Democratic.
So, Ed, in your opinion, the person in the congressional delegation right now most at risk of getting their chair pulled in a case of musical chairs is Lisa McLean.
Right now, because she's the freshman. I think there'd be a lot of support for the Myers, the district, to retain because they like him. She's not a blind, but it's a political pressure. So I can eliminate Myers' district or McLean's. I can still retain the two black seats, and I can decide who that other district's going to be. It's going to be hard to eliminate a Democratic seat because there's more Democratic population across the state than there is Democratic. So the issue is going to be is what Republican is more likely to get hit.
But you can't do very much to Jack Bergman.
Yeah, I think he's safe up there in the Upper Peninsula. I don't think he's at risk.
He could capture Drummond Island, get over into Illinois or Wisconsin, and pick up some territory there.
I think the other person who may be jeopardized by the next redistricting might be Tim Walberg, because I had something to do with the way lines were drawn in 2011. And, you know, we gave him a real gift by taking Calhoun out of the 7th district and giving it to the 3rd. You know, that kind of checkmated, Mark Schauer from having a Walberg Schauer 3 contest once Calhoun was taken out of the 7th district. So McLean and Walberg will probably be most impacted by this redistricting that will be done by this independent redistricting commission.
And the only reason why Walberg even has a chance, because if there's any influence, Debbie Dingell does not want Monroe County.
I really think that the independent redistricting commission, they didn't hire any people that were all that directly impacted from voters, not politicians. And they avoided anybody that had some sort of partisan taint, you know, whether it was just making contributions to candidates or things like that. And as a result, I think you're going to make a good faith effort to draw the lines. I have no idea what a community of interest is. And so it'll be interesting to see what this commission does. Since that's really, after you get past the Voting Rights Act, that's the next highest criteria. Communities of interest in other states, when they've applied it, it's who can pack the hearings and read off the same 3x5 index card that has a strong impact on these independent redistricting commissioners. And so we'll see how that plays out, you know, later on this year when they take in public, you know, input.
And the other thing that they got to concern themselves, once they define their rules, then they may be challenged at either the state or Supreme Court level. What was wrong with the court adopted rules and the Bernie April plan of criteria? They have to justify why did they switch those rules? Because those were a nonpartisan set of rules voted on, well, led by the Judge Levin at that time. But the point being is they could be sued on why did you take what has been working in Michigan for a number of years?
I'm not so concerned about litigation kind of changing what the constitutional amendment provided for. Unfortunately, I think what the constitutional amendment provided for is really undefined. I don't know what communities of interest mean. And I don't know about the criteria that says no district shall have a disproportionate advantage to a political party. What do you do with districts in the city of Detroit where they're 90%+ Democratic? Those will be interesting decisions that will be made by this commission. And also, I have a sense, however, that when the bottom line comes down, these commissioners are going to be heavily influenced on how their map looks. And if they got all sorts of twisty, lines, a lot of the public will think that these should be as compact as possible. That doesn't necessarily agree with all the criteria in the constitutional amendment. But it'll be interesting to see what eventually happens there.
Also, if you listen to any of their meetings, if you talk to people who've been in those committee meetings, when discussion, well, what is a fair plan? How do we define a fair plan? And someone says, well, it's like the nonpartisan issue. It's got to be balanced. Well, then, how do we know what it is? We need a partisan database to determine that. So the bottom line is they're already realizing in some of their meetings, in fact, is that they don't have the tools necessary to decide what the fair plan is. Because remember, they're trying to deal with no partisan information at all. And they're now being told within their own committee meetings by their own members, we're going to have to decide how do we judge what the district's Republican or Democrat, which goes back to what Bob said. How is it going to look? And then how do they decide what's a fair plan?
What's the latest they could finish a plan? And what's the last kind of drop dead date?
Probably March or April of next year.
That doesn't give people a lot of time to make decisions, though, if you're a legislator.
Well, we've been there before. I will tell you that. We've been there before in previous redistricting. We're going down to the fat. Remember, Chris Thomas, I don't get it by March 6th or April 1st. So we've been there before. And they just got to be sure they got enough time to run the primary election in August.
The last time we really had to deal with deadlines and times spans is it was probably in 1982. I think the commission will come up with plans in accord with the timeline that's spelled out in the Michigan Constitution, regardless of whether there's a delay in getting the real data from the U.S. Census Bureau. I think there'll be plenty of time to deal with that.
All right. Well, we're going to close on that. Thank you so much, Ed Tsarpoulos and Bob LeBrant, for joining us on this section of the podcast. We'll be back with the folks from the Michigan Manufacturers Association. Join us now for the podcast is John Walsh and Mike Johnston. They are with the Michigan Manufacturers Association. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, guys.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
The Michigan Manufacturers Association has put out their agenda for 2021 and presumably 22 for this session anyway. And the big subject that seems to be dominating the legislature right now has to do with unemployment, the Unemployment Trust Fund. And the governor said that she does not want general fund money to go into the Unemployment Trust Fund. And guys, what's the problem with that?
Well, it's kind of the bird's eye view is government is always facing unlimited needs and limited resources. So the governor has to take a look at her priorities with the legislature and try to determine where best to spend the general fund dollars. Our position, simply put, is that we think it is a priority for the government to put money into the trust fund. Our employers, we were glad to pay into it. We were glad that we had it as healthy as it was to begin with. But now we're weakened after a very, very difficult year. And it's an awfully expensive proposition if we have to fill that in without help from the state. I'll go to Mike for a little more detail, but just a couple of bird's eye views there.
But doesn't this set a dangerous precedent then, Mike? Because once the general fund starts kicking into the UI fund, it can become a trend, and then all of a sudden it becomes like a regular deal. And should state government have to pay for a fund that currently is paid by business?
Well, look, these are unprecedented times. The COVID pandemic just collapsed the fund. We started out last year at about $4.6 billion. After spending a decade building it from a deficit of about $4 billion. So, we've got about an $8 or $9 billion swing paid for by employers. Start out this year with a plush fund, and then COVID hit and wipes it out. Now we're looking at insolvency, even borrowing from the federal government, even no interest loans. require being paid back. This can be very, very expensive. The justification for unemployment insurance for employees is they're unemployed through no fault of their own. Here's a case where the trust fund collapsed through no fault of the employers. So we think government has a role to play. More likely federal government should play a role. And the governor's actually said that. We'll work with the governor on getting federal funds to backfill the fund. But also you saw before the end of the year, we supported a bill that put $220 million of general fund in there to cover what the governor called for is 26-week expansion. And our position there was, well, if you want to expand that, then you should pay for it. And the governor vetoed it. Now she also vetoed the 26 weeks. So I think there's a lot more discussion to be had there.
Well, you cracked open the door on 26 weeks here. And John, why don't I go back to you here? What's wrong with going back to the 26 weeks of benefits that those who are unemployed received up until the Snyder years?
We're not arguing that 26 weeks is just inherently bad. What we're suggesting is during the negotiations, we have to work with the government. The unemployment and the impact to the individuals involved, and therefore the impact on the trust fund, and then again on employers, was government induced. The pandemic caused it. Then reactions to that resulted in this massive unemployment. We used the trust fund appropriately. We're willing to have the conversation on 20 to 26 weeks because of the perilous times and the circumstances. But our position has always been to hold at 20 when possible under normal circumstances. So, well, it's a negotiation. It's an ongoing negotiation. And it comes down to what can employers in our society afford moving forward with compassion.
Can you guys explain for our listeners what happens if there is no general fund support this time around? What happens to the fund? What happens next sequentially? Do rates go up? How does that work?
Yeah, I'm going to flip to Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, what happens is there are federal regulations about solvency in the fund. If you get to a certain level, the federal government requires you to borrow. In state borrow. So you now have the employers have to pay those loans back. Sometimes they say no interest loans, sometimes interest loans, but there's all sorts of penalties if you don't do that. In state law, there was a requirement that when the fund hit $2.5 billion, it triggers a taxable wage base increase from $9,000 up to $9,500. So there was a tax increase a few months ago, and then there'll be increased borrowing forced by the federal government. And so that's another tax increase. So employers are looking at a double and potential triple whammy in terms of tax increases. If you expand from 20 to 26 weeks, we estimated that cost, and the legislature moved the bills at $220 million. So there's another tax increase. But also, as the fund goes down, everybody's experience rating is hit. Much of it was in non-chargeable benefits relative to the federal benefits. But hey, there's a cost there spread among all the employers who contribute to the fund. I mean, just a quick reminder, that fund is paid for only by employers historically.
And rates, do they vary by state, or are they all the same across states? I mean, where are we competitively?
Every state has its own dynamic relative to its own economy and its own rates, because the design of the federal government is to keep the fund solvent. So yeah, it varies by state. To be clear, there's a federal basis with some federal or state modification, but basically a federal program.
How does Michigan compare to the Great Lakes states, just out of curiosity?
Michigan actually has a lower tax rate because we're at 20 weeks compared to 26 weeks. We actually have a competitive advantage.
When you look across the states, though, it does seem like 26 weeks is more the standard, and we're on the low end with 20 weeks of benefits. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's everybody knows. There are about 40 states at 26, and Michigan's at 20. That was one, as I said, it's a competitive advantage for Michigan, and we have few competitive advantages, and let's make sure we're protecting those. To get from 20 to 26 is a tax increase.
Now, one of the things that the governor would like to see that the legislature is balking on is this idea of extending this program called Good Jobs for Michigan. And this is an incentive that is used to spur development in which those who receive the Good Jobs incentive are able to collect the income tax they would normally pay the state and put it back into their project. John, I want to start with you on this. So how do you convince the Republican legislature that now is the time to do this when they're really pretty leery of the program?
Yeah, and indeed they are. Kyle, I'm certainly supportive. Our organization is supportive of it. We've given that information to both the administration and to legislators. We always are striving for an environment that keeps and attracts employers. And to keep and attract employers, we need good people here. Good jobs attracts high-quality people. And so our argument to the legislators as we move forward with the session is we need to attract good people here. We need more investment. You know, Michigan made some very, very difficult decisions on the pandemic. And we do have members that have moved some of their employees out of state simply to make certain that they could continue production at a point where we were shut down and other states were not. So we're at a little bit of a disadvantage vis-a-vis some other states, Ohio in particular, in keeping jobs here, you know, and investment. We want people to know that Michigan is open and good for business. Good jobs is one way of showing that. And having worked on it first and foremost while I was still with the Senator administration, but also keeping tabs now in my current role, I think it's a well-defined program that is understandable and it doesn't lead to the runaway costs of the old mega grants.
MyOSHA. How do you feel MyOSHA is doing? Is there any adjustments that you feel like need to be made on that? Michael, why don't I take that question to you?
Yeah, so the MyOSHA established an emergency rule back in October that lasts for 6 months. They can extend it when it was October 14th, so about April 14th. They can extend it or modify it. And so when that transition happens, we'll be working with MyOSHA to say, hey, let's look at remote work. Let's look at flexibility given the expansion of the vaccine and how close we're getting to herd immunity. Let's look at what level of flexibility we can get in terms of getting people back to work. While I think remote work has worked well for a lot of people, I don't think anyone fully disagrees with the notion that people back in the shop is probably the most effective way. So we want to move in that direction if possible.
So what kind of restrictions are your members facing right now as far as people at work? Because it seems like manufacturing, you actually need people in the shops to make things.
Yeah, manufacturing actually been pretty lucky. We were one of the first first sectors to open. And frankly, MyOSHA has been pretty flexible with us. One of our things we proposed right out of the gate was temperature taking at the gate when you come in the door. And they've allowed some flexibility on that. And so we want to continue to work with MyOSHA to find other ways to be flexible to make sure we're as competitive as we can be in the global economy.
You know, Kyle, to that point, MyOSHA and the Whitmer administration has actually been quite open to our suggestions. And like in any aspect of our lives, personal or professional, you don't always get what you ask for, but MyOSHA has been great to work with. And they recognized that manufacturing is in the business of risk mitigation on site. We've been at it for a long time, working with regulators and employees, and they've been very open to our suggestions, and thankfully our willingness to work with them, I think, helped us be one of the first industries back up and get running.
Has there been many outbreaks or issues with COVID in plants in Michigan?
No, they've been, you know, the governor had a chart for a number of months that would show the outbreaks seemingly difficult, but we're somewhere around about 200 since May, roughly. And an outbreak, so I use the air quotes, is really an incident, John. It's not necessarily a transmission from one employee to another, but rather somebody at the door fails a temperature check or can't answer the questions in the right way, meaning they shouldn't be admitted. They're sent home at that point. That's a reported quote unquote outbreak. The incident of transmission is exceedingly small. I don't have the exact number, but it's very, very small. And to put it into perspective, we're lumped with construction for some historic reasons. Manufacturing and construction is lumped together as a site, a work site. More than half of the outbreaks have been on construction sites. And the other thing to point out, though, between the two, it's 40,000 work sites. So to have an incident, as I call it, somebody at the door and sent home, being around 200 is rather small. Thankfully, we've not had a problem in a particular plant. Early on, it was difficult, but people figured it out. We've been very safe.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because on the state statistics where they look at outbreaks, it goes schools and then what's second, nursing homes first, then schools, and then manufacturing and construction. But what you're saying is that it's because you have such a huge number of people that you're working with here. Your universe of people are so large. Obviously, the quote-unquote outbreaks are going to happen more in manufacturing and construction.
Right, and a lot of it has to do with how it's a statistics issue. If you look at the charts, there were periods where the schools were number one and universities were maybe number seven, just to give you an example of how the stats work. But the incident, there wasn't transmission in the schools. It was, again, somebody that arrived at work and was sent home because they couldn't get in the door or they felt badly at school. The possibility of transmission was 15 times that in the university reporting category because transmissions were very, very high. So more people were infected, but they had less numbers of incidents, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So we've worked very closely with the Department of Public Health and the administration to have a greater refinement on that so that people can get a better sense of what is a hotspot and what isn't.
One of the areas that I want to touch on here was talent, because I know that's a big issue for the MMA. I'm trying to find out where the controversy is, if there is any, on the issue of talent. Does it have to do so much as to who is paying for the training, whether it's the state or business, or who is doing the training, whether it's a community college or a union shop or something? Help me out on that.
It's not a controversy. I think it's a couple of things. In terms of payment, should it be an employer or the state in some methodology or the federal government? We think there's a healthy mix. What makes it difficult is programs come and go. They can be very, very helpful, but they might be short-term in duration. And with each new program is a new regulatory environment, for lack of a better description. It's actually a bureaucratic environment, how you apply for the funds and how you can administer them. The other issue is trying to find a framework, and this is something that we're going to focus on as an association, is to work with community colleges, technical training centers, and others to define common certifications that make sense. Something that if you get a certification from Macomb County Community College, it should be just as valuable should you move for whatever reason over to Grand Rapids, so that you don't have to go to Grand Rapids Community College for a separate certification for that employer. So we're trying to work on commonality, kind of degree certification programs that are understandable and portable. Access, is it on site or at the workplace? So it's a couple of different layers, and we're going to try and be the broker, for lack of a better description. We're going to get out there and work closely with educational institutions and our employers to move forward. The last thing I think, Kyle, what I have found over the years is employers are not always direct in the actual number of jobs that they need. And so if they're hesitant to declare that they need 20 CNC operators, I'm just picking a category, and they say, well, we need one or two, a community college or a training center isn't going to react to that in the same way. Okay. So we need a little more honesty and transparency from the employers. What's the real number? What's the real need?
And then, Mike, the last question I wanted to ask on the agenda here, how much different has the Whitmer administration been to the Snyder administration when it comes to environmental enforcement of policies?
Frankly, I don't see a big difference. I mean, Eagle's focus is protecting the human health and the environment. And our focus is exactly the same, with the addition of let's make sure we're getting permits in a timely and predictable way. I don't see a dramatic difference. I think the Flint dynamic has changed the world a little bit. Now DHS and Eagle are working more closely, and it complicates the cleanup standards a little bit. But I don't see a dramatic shift.
And then, John, I also wanted to touch on another subject here with you, if we can go off topic here a bit. You were a part of the Snyder administration. You ended as his budget director. I wanted to get your thoughts on what has happened in Flint and him being criminally charged.
Well, I think it's a shame that he was criminally charged. I haven't read the entire charge. It's most what I've heard from the news, but it's dereliction of duty. I don't know that that's a defined crime. you know, it's almost like they're fishing for a cause. I have two thoughts, Kyle. One, I have a great deal of respect and admiration for Rick Snyder. He was not only my boss, he's become my friend over the years, and I think he has done wonderful things for the state of Michigan, including trying to react to the problems in Flint. We could spend hours, you know, what happened and what was the response, but in my personal opinion, I think he did the best that he could with his administration in responding. What I'm also concerned about, though, is forevermore, elected officials will start to have to worry about whether or not a decision that they make in good faith based on the information available to them will result in a criminal charge. Can a prosecutor now be charged if they fail to bring an action against an alleged criminal that goes out and commits another crime? You know, I could go on and give you example after an example. Could Governor Whitmer be charged, or other governors be charged, for decisions that were very difficult having to do with patients and sending them to a nursing home? That may have been a good idea, may have been a bad idea. The result was difficult and bad. But is that criminal? I don't think so. The problem is now everyone that runs for office, it's already hard enough to get people interested to run for office. It is really a rather vile area to work in. I thank God for people that still want to run and serve. It's one thing to be called a name or said you did something wrong, but if you're going to have to face criminal charges, Kyle, I think that is an enormously detrimental circumstance for our country to face.
All right, John Walsh and Mike Johnson with the Michigan Manufacturers Association, thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, joining us now on the podcast is Dennis Lennox, a longtime political consultant in Michigan. And Dennis, you gave me a call after you heard our last podcast with Mark Grebner. What were you thinking when you heard that?
Look, Kyle, I could say that Mark Grebner is this creepy, weird dude, but I won't say that. What I will say, I've never said there was widespread fraud. But what I have said is that there were repeated irregular actions taken, particularly by the Secretary of State, that I believe were unlawful, and they were an attempt by the Democrats to game the system, particularly given the fact that we had some new aspects of our voting system in Michigan, thanks to the ballot question in 2018, that were relatively untested in the state.
But he had your voter registration card that showed that you indeed had checked the box that you wanted an absentee ballot for the general and the primary election, and you had said that you did not do that for the general election. Did he catch you?
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's just weird, right? I mean, to go around, you know, requesting that sort of information, I guess he cruises around the internet, you know, looking for stuff to research. But the reality is, I stand by my statement. I received a unsolicited absentee ballot application, no differently than millions of other Michiganders who woke up one day and was surprised to see an unsolicited application arrive at their house. I filled out the application form to the best of my knowledge and belief. I only checked the primary box. If I wanted to get a absentee ballot application in the general election, I would have checked the box that said both. In fact, when you look at the application form that he sent along, it sure appears to be a completely different X and a completely different ink pen for the general election box.
So are you suggesting that there could be something happening here or what?
Look, I think there was a lot of incompetence. I think there was a lot of maladministration at all levels of the state this year. We see it cycle after cycle in Detroit. You see it in township after township when you have part-time, poorly trained clerks who have ballots and applications just sitting around their living room. And there's lots of human errors and mistakes, particularly when you have voters who historically vote absentee, and sometimes clerks make good faith mistakes. It happened in Macomb County a few years ago with the former clerk there, where there were some issues with absentee ballot voting. We have a former clerk now in my township where I live. She's no longer the clerk. She was an older lady. It's quite possible she made a mistake. I don't know. Frankly, I could care less. But I do stand by my position that I only intended to get an absentee ballot application for the primary election. And I believe that the facts support that. And frankly, I know how to fill out forms. And I would have checked the box that said both.
One more thing I want to ask you about, as far as any allegations of voter fraud. Do you feel like there was enough voter fraud or any voter fraud in the state of Michigan to alter any results in this election, past election?
You know, I've never said there was widespread fraud. I think there's no question that there were irregular actions on the part of election officials in Detroit. There was incompetence, gross incompetence. I'll even use a bigger word, maladministration in Antrim County. That happens every cycle. We had an unfamiliar system this year with a lot of big changes, and you had a Democrat Secretary of State trying to gain a partisan advantage. You know, I remember one of the first elections I was ever involved in the 2006 cycle. We had a county commissioner race in Sheboygan County, my home county. In the primary, it was a two-township county commissioner race, and it went to a recount. It was like 11 votes or something like that that was in dispute, you know, would have changed the outcome. Except the largest precinct in the district, two precincts, couldn't be recounted because the proper procedures weren't followed to seal those ballots, preserve them. That happens all the time. It's unacceptable. I've long said I think our elections in Michigan, in many cases, are run worse than third world countries. That doesn't mean there's widespread fraud. But there's certainly a pattern, a long-standing pattern, under Democrat and Republican clerks and Democrat and Republican secretaries of state of irregular actions and maladministration.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the boss, John Rurink, and John Walsh, Mike Johnston with the Michigan Manufacturers Association, also Ed Zarpolis, Bob LeBrant, Dennis Lennox. And also thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
Happy trails.